Hello, my name is Brian McKenna. I'm one of the editors at Computer Weekly, and I'm here to bid you a very warm welcome indeed to the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
podcast.
And those two other voices were?
I'm Caroline Donnelly. I'm a senior editor at Computer Weekly.
I'm Claire McDonald. I'm the business editor at Computer Weekly.
Now, before we get stuck into the podcast,
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Caroline.
Happy birthday to you.
Oh, thank you.
Hooray.
Anymore? Okay, no. That's very kind of you. Like I said, the birthday card I got off the Computer Weekly team is my first and only, so it's the best one I've had so far. And yeah, being at work on your birthday is not the most fun, but that was very pleasant.
No, it's not. I usually end up doing it because mine is usually around conference time in kind of March, April.
So do you end up at conferences on your birthday? That's the worst.
Much.
It's not great, is it?
No.
Well, last week we kicked off the podcast looking at three of the candidates for the Tory leadership. Rory Stewart, Boris Johnson and Michael Gove. Theresa May goes today, doesn't she? Mm-hmm. As leader of the Tory party.
Yeah.
But she's still Prime Minister.
Mm-hmm. Does that make her a partyless Prime Minister?
No.
She'll still be a Conservative politician.
Yeah, she's still the MP for Maiden.
But just not the head of party. Mm-hmm. She has been dethroned.
Yeah. Yeah.
Politics.
Yes, until, I think it's like the middle of July.
All right.
22nd, something like that. And this week we're going to look at Matt Hancock. He of the app.
Mm-hmm.
Matt Hancock app. Penny Mordaunt.
Yep.
And Dominic Raab.
Mm-hmm.
As for the rest of the podcast, Claire, Big Women in Tech Focus.
Yep, my favourite.
Caroline's been out and about.
Yes, I have. Everywhere from Hayes in West London to Monaco. So two very glamorous locations.
Glamour. Yeah. On the cloud trail as ever. I'm going to talk about autonomous boats.
Okay.
For a bit. But let's begin with these Tories. Caroline, we've said in other podcasts that Matt Hancock is probably the most digitally savvy of the Tory ministers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
is this true?
Yes, I've been doing some research into him. Yes, he is. He's had various roles in like DCMS, more recently at the NHS, he's Health Secretary and stuff, and previously the Cabinet Office as well, and I think he's been renowned for always putting technology sort of front and centre of any of the initiatives he's had in any of those roles. So Brian, our gaffer, Brian Glick, interviewed him last year about, you know, his, well, I think in his position as Health Secretary, but at the same time also sort of, you know, trying to get to the grips with as to why, like, why is technology so important for the health service and stuff like that. So it's something he's championed ever since he he seems to have been in politics, really. And I was trying to do a bit of digging into why that is, like, why is he so, you know, focused on, he talked about data a lot, you know, breaking down data silos, making better use of data. And yeah, so I looked into it. He's kind of like a politics, I think an economics kind of graduate and stuff like that, but his family, this is as much as I could find out on Wikipedia.
Yeah, he did PP at Exeter College, Oxford.
Oxford connection. Told you, Brian might know. all I could find on Wikipedia really was that his family had a computer software business that he worked at briefly. But there's no further details, so I don't know if he left that under a cloud, like, no pun intended.
Are you saying, you know when you type your, like, beginning of your address into... He said his family came up with that software.
So if you just type in your house number, then it fills in.
And it goes, oh, this is where you live. I didn't know that.
Oh, that is good use of data, you know, fair play to...
But I don't know what it was called, or... I think he sold the business as well.
So I was looking into that, and that's kind of his background in tech. But yeah, he's talked a good game since he's been health minister about, like, setting up this organisation called NHSX. He was supposed to be leading the, you know, digitisation of the NHS across every NHS body and stuff like that. That's quite a new thing.
Yeah.
And then when he first took on the role, apparently he pledged that there was going to be a funding injection for technology stuff, about $487 million for the NHS. You know, now he was in charge. And we've covered on previous podcasts his kind of
around the digitisation push, his desire to get rid of outdated outdated technologies, you know, the fax, get rid of pagers,
all of that.
Yeah, so he's...
All the stuff that proved its value at Holby City.
Yeah, exactly. As we
as we covered.
Yeah, without pagers, that the hospital would have been on its knees. People would be dead. What characters in the programme? But, so he's very... Like I say, probably out of all the candidates, he's probably the one who's most... You know, who's probably got the biggest technology kind of experience and stuff like that, like you said. So... Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that shapes up, whether or not... Because he does get... You mentioned he's got the app and stuff like that, and he does kind of leave himself open for kind of a bit of good-natured kind of criticism around all this. I looked it up, actually, the app, on the Google App Store. It's got a 3.4 rating out of 5, so I don't know if that's indicative of his general kind of how good is he at tech. But if we use that, that's how Mac Hancock... the app is rated as good at technology.
What can you do with the app?
Yeah, what is the app for?
I think, I don't know if it's been updated. Cause I was like, do I download it? Or do I? And I was like, no, I don't think I want to download it. I don't want to add to that. And I think it's for helping his constituents just keep tabs on him. Like, what's Matt up to? I haven't seen him for a while. I see him on the news. I see him kind of fluffing his interviews on Women's Hour and stuff like that. I don't know what... Where is he? Where is that guy? So I think if you want to keep tabs on him, you can. But then I remember when people first started downloading it, and it says something like, when you download the app, you know, they always come to these screens and said, oh, do you want this company to have access to your files and stuff? And
there's
there's this thing came up saying, do you want Matt Hancock to access your photos and data? No!
Matt Hancock, no!
Time will tell, as it were, whether or not he'll be successful. But I know, like I say, Brian... Brian Glick seems quite taken with him, just because, as you said, I think previously, you know, that his feeling is that anyone who's taken any position of power in politics or anything needs to be digitally literate because of how, you know, our economy is becoming increasingly digital. So
yeah, the digitally literate will take over the world.
Yeah, so we'll see, you know, if Matt Hancock is among them or if he's just
quite a landmark interview, wasn't it, that Brian did with...
Yeah, I think, didn't he have sit there with a mug with Matt Hancock written on it, and it was...
His own mug, it had his own name on it.
Yeah.
What, in case he forgot it?
Well, I think, I'm sure there was something like that in it, and it was just like, God, he's got his own app, he's got his own mug, he's got the merch, if nothing else, so, yeah, fair play.
And he gets shit done.
Yeah, that's what he said he's going to do.
This week, I think.
Yeah.
Get shit done.
Yeah. He's been quite vocal this week with Trump saying, you know, the NHS is on the table in the trade negotiations, and he's been like, no, it's not. Stand away. Hands off. So, yeah. So.
And of course, Boris Johnson famously said, fuck business, didn't he?
Did he?
And Matt Hancock has said, I see, fuck business. So there you go.
So that's like a double negative. So I don't really know how that works.
He's very street.
Yeah.
Street!
Really?
He's down with the kids.
Oh god, I think he'd love to be. There's quite a good picture of him that someone said, oh my god, he looks like the man from Debenhams or something. There's like him sort of standing at the sidelines of an event waiting to talk, and he's got like kind of jeans on and kind of trainers and like, hey, I do digital.
Yeah.
Like, oh god, no.
Digital people don't wear suits.
Yeah, like, hey guys, let's talk ditch. So
But he is talking the talk, and he does He does have some hinterland in our world of business tech. So,
yes.
Fair play to the man.
Yeah, and we could be blackballed now because, you know, like we say, he's technologically literate.
Mm-hmm.
And then if he ends up in number 10, he might just decide he hates Computer Weekly now after what we just said about him. So.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, well.
I don't think we said anything that bad.
No. Nothing that wasn't in the public domain already.
No.
That he's already said himself. So. Yeah, and credit where credit is due, and all that. Let's turn to Penny Mordaunt, the first woman to be a defence minister.
Yeah, so she used to be the Women and Equalities Minister, and now first female defence minister, which I think that's actually quite cool, and I think that it brings about a different perspective to defending our nation. So as far as I could find out, she still has a women and equalities focus with quite a lot of the stuff she does. Apparently she was meant to meet Ivanka.
Oh, yeah.
That's what she was this week.
Yeah, and they were meant to be talking about proposals for sort of like a government women's empowerment strategy, but she was stood up.
So Ivanka, however you say her name, Ivanka. Stood her up.
Yeah, so they didn't meet, and apparently there has been, you know, like provisions for a new meeting put in place, but yeah, like they didn't get to meet and chat about women's empowerment, so that's nice. But yeah, so as far as technology goes, there's been a push to develop cyber capabilities in the military. So there's already been billions of pounds of funding in a national cyber security strategy, part of which was to train people in cyber skills and so sort of enable the military and the army, etc., with more cyber defence. And she recently announced a further £22 million fund for an army cyber operations centre to add to this sort of cyber side to defence in the army and the military. You know, give people more skills.
It's increasingly important because, you know, there's, well, I say scare stories, but then we've seen the debilitating impact that cyber attacks can have. But yeah, but with stuff around, like, the next world war could be fought online, like, by people behind keyboards.
We saw what happened at Holby City as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you want to bring it home.
She said that she doesn't want cyber enemies to feel like they can act and go unnoticed. She wants people to know that we have that line of defence. A digital army, maybe.
Cool. And she is a Royal Navy reservist herself, isn't she? Yeah.
And I read somewhere that she was a magician's assistant for a bit.
She was?
Really? Yeah.
In Portsmouth.
Yeah.
God. See, that's what I want. I want my politicians to have lived a life. Exactly. You know, had some real, you know, done a real job at the coalface. Have that experience.
She's been in it.
Yeah, she has. Yeah.
I think she's made big strides for defence, and she seems like the sort of level-headed, down-to-earth person that I would quite enjoy having run the country.
Yes.
Okay, well, big vote for Penny there.
I'm going to find out now that she's done, like, really bad shit. I'm going to be like, I take it all back.
Yeah.
No, she seems, she does seem quite fun as well. Definitely. Dominic Raab has not been, to my knowledge, Defence Secretary, has he? Has he been in the Defence Department in any way?
I've got no idea. But
he is very keen on karate.
Oh, okay, really?
Massively keen on karate is Dominic. And I suppose the thing that he's most famous for this week, you know, is this idea of proroguing Parliament. So you just shut Parliament down.
Okay, I'm interested.
And then push Brexit through.
Oh,
just
no. Okay, less interesting. I like the shut down Parliament bit. Didn't like the bit that followed. So.
What were you imagining during this shutdown of Parliament?
Just like, oh, just what, stop it. Everything ends.
That's a very good question. What would you replace it with?
I don't know.
Should we give the Queen back all her power?
Well, that's what I was hoping would happen. She would sail in at some point and go, no, this is going on too long. Out, all of you.
But this is the sort of thing that the Stuart Kings did, in fact, do, which is why we had a civil war.
I was going to say, there's massive backlash. I don't think it ended very well. But,
not for him. He got his head chopped off.
Yeah.
That was a bad day.
I'm all for a bit of anarchy, though. Just like, this isn't working. Nothing's going to get sorted just playing by the rules or trying to do things properly. Let's just, I don't know. Let's do something.
But it depends what your idea of anarchy is. Standing outside the pub drinking.
No.
Instead of being at work.
No, just kind of like, let's just do something. Like, I was all for Berko just shutting the whole thing down, derailing Brexit.
Berko is the one who's coming to the rescue of this because he stood up in the House of Commons and said, no way is this going to happen.
Yeah.
So forget it.
Yeah, so that's what I'm all for.
But, okay. Yeah. Let's not go down that rabbit hole.
No. So Dominic Raab, he does have some things in his background which I find quite appealing. He's got a Czech father who escaped the Nazis and came to Britain.
Wow.
So a bit of a kind of Miliband connection there, in a way, similar thing. And among his kind of human rights, and because he's a lawyer, he has worked for, you know, one of the players in the Palestinian situation. So he's you know, he's got some things in his background which you might not predict. And nevertheless, he is a very keen Brexiteer. He is one of the kind of global Britain neoliberal. It'll all be great once we get out of the stagnating, sclerotic, dying on its feet European Union and start trading all over the world. He is one of those.
Okay. I should have found out Penny Mordaunt's stance on Brexit, really, shouldn't I? It's probably one of the more important things at the moment.
But then he didn't know where Doe
was coming on to I was there at that meeting.
Oh, were you? So what happened?
Yeah, I reported on this for Computer Weekly. I was at that infamous Tech Nation event on the 7th of November last year, where he actually gave a very good talk for about an hour about his vision of
and then he completely
Brexit and so on and so forth.
Crumbled.
And in the Q&A session, I asked him this question. I said, Dominic, you're very keen on Brexit. You really believe in it. So tell us about why Brexit would be good for the UK AI industry.
Right.
There's a lot of, you know, rhetoric, as we know, government rhetoric about the artificial intelligence. We talked about this on this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that, I've got the quote here, if you do Brexit right, the AI industry will benefit. He said there's all sorts of risks with Brexit. Not saying there won't be issues or challenges, but if we maintain data flows and the integrity of those, smart regulation at home within EU equivalence regulatory approaches, he actually said all this, it was actually off the cuff, while we forge strong relations with growth markets around the world in Latin America and Asia, then there is great scope for the artificial intelligence industry in the UK. So he says some other things in response to my question as well, which I won't kind of labour. It's in the piece, still on the website, of course. But the thing that he was famous for at that event was a kind of brief a side comment that he made almost under his breath. He said this: we want a bespoke arrangement on goods which recognises the peculiar, frankly, geographic and economic entity that is the United Kingdom. We are, and I hadn't quite understood the full extent of this, but if you look at the UK and how we trade in goods, we are super reliant on the Dover-Calais crossing. And that is one of the reasons why, and then he goes on and on about to talk about the need for frictionless trade around goods, because you know, that's the Chequers Agreement, that was the kind of compromise that we would have some sort of customs arrangement for goods but not for services. Now, sitting in the room, pretty much everyone missed this, but because it was being live streamed, that clip was taken and then blown up into this. This guy doesn't know anything about trade between Dover and Calais. What an idiot, etc., etc. And it, you know, it's been a big kind of black mark on his career.
Yeah,
just goes to show that just a little brief aside, not scripted.
Yeah,
and he was kind of what he was kind of doing, I think, and I know our colleague from the Register thought the same thing. That he was kind of trying to make people in the room feel okay, saying, I hadn't quite realised the full extent of this myself, so don't you feel bad.
Don't you feel bad about not knowing this.
And how many of us really know the precise percentage of global, you know, trade between Dover and Calais? I couldn't tell you.
Yeah,
that.
Just found out he'd heard about it for the first time. Like, oh yeah.
Yeah, he's like, oh, I was looking at it, and it turns out.
When there's people in this country who've been using that for like the booze cruise, like quite informally for years, like just head over to France, load up your car, load cheap booze from the supermarket, and then go home again. That's, you know, come on, Dominic. That's the kind of, an MP who knows that exists is what we need. Like, I said, real people of the people.
They've lived.
Yeah. He obviously hasn't.
Yeah, so there's a part, there's a partial defence of Dominic Raab, but I'm not keen on him being Prime Minister.
Mm-hmm.
He does have a personal connection. We're talking about Matt Hancock. He does have a personal connection to the technology and industry insofar as his partner works for Google. In marketing. I had a quick look for her on LinkedIn, and we are connected, but I guess I shouldn't really say exactly what she does.
No.
Yeah, or who she is.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
His wife. Well, you just said that.
This does.
Yeah, but you know.
It's not names now.
Yeah. I mean, anyone who's good at jigsaw identification is putting together those facts.
Could probably figure it out, but I'm not going to say precisely what her job title is, although you can find it if you want to, listeners.
Just reverse engineer your search through Brian's LinkedIn connection and you should find her.
Well, I think we're all connected to her. We're all bound to be connected to her.
Okay.
I'm not. I'm really bad at LinkedIn.
Well, apart from you then. So yes, that was the ill-fated technician speech. So Erica Ray, who is the partner of Dominic Raab, is
you named names.
Oh no, this is public. This is public knowledge.
Okay.
It's been paraded around as all the partners of the various contenders have been. Contrived link. So she's a woman in tech, and we're going to talk about women in tech.
We are. I actually quite liked that link. Sorry we messed it up for you.
Well, that's part of the magic of the link.
So, Women in Tech, this week we launched our nominations process for the top 50 most influential women in UK tech.
Mm-hmm.
We do this every year. It's been running since 2012. Back in 2012, it was only a list of 25 women. Now it's a list of 50, plus rising stars, plus our Hall of Fame, for people who have just done so much that they deserve special recognition, and previous winners of the list go on the Hall of Fame as well. So yeah, the nominations are open. You can put forward your women in tech for the list.
So the Hall of Fame, is that so that you know, the same people don't keep appearing on the top 50 and to make room for new people to kind of get a place on that as well, so you still acknowledge their achievements, but you know, makes room for new people as well?
Yeah, exactly. So there are a number of people on the Hall of Fame, people that have won previously, people who have appeared on the list several times. We still want to recognize them.
Mm-hmm.
They have done a lot for the tech industry and for the women in tech parts of the industry.
Yeah, so it's not like, okay, you've had your go,
done now.
Yeah.
No, exactly. Mm-hmm.
That's the thing about lists, isn't it? You know, if you're on it 1 year and then not the next,
there's
the potential to get cross.
You're like, what have I done?
What have I done to be kicked off?
Well, that's why we have the criteria for the judging on the website, so that people can understand what we're looking for in the women that reach the top 50. So it's not just about being a woman. It's about your influence in the industry. It's about what you've been doing in your career to advance technology, and it's also about what you've done to help other women to get their recognition and their place in the industry as well.
Yeah, no, it's a fabulous thing that we do now. When will it be announced?
In September/October, so we will be having our annual diversity and inclusion event, and it will be announced at that event, but we need to pin down a venue, and as soon as we do, everyone will know.
Because I've been here 4 years, and even just in 4 years, it seems to have got bigger and bigger every year. And the reaction we get to it seems to get bigger as well. So
yeah, it's always really exciting. It's one of my favourite things.
Cool. So excitement, tech, haze.
My hometown, very exciting place. So I went to go and visit Rackspace's UK HQ. Formerly known as Rackspace City, but it's
really cool. Is it known as that?
Locally? It used to be. It was. They obviously Rackspace have gone through some challenging times in recent years, but they used to have the entire site, and that was Rackspace City. And then they just have a little portion of it now, so it's kind of downsized from Rackspace City to just Rackspace HQ. But I went. I was invited there for a tour of the facilities, and I don't know. Like Brian, you've done a lot of tours around like Silicon Valley and things like that, and they're always quite strange things going into someone else's office.
Mm.
And I don't know, I remember one from a few years ago. I think I can mention the company by name because they went out of business. Outsourcery. They were like a cloud kind of comms company, and they invited me to their offices in near Charlotte Street or something, I think it was. And they were like, hey, come and look at our office. Like, we're just like Google. We've got a barbecue and a balcony. I was like, okay. So I walked into Rackspace, and as soon as you walk in, there was like a putting green. And there's this huge auditorium where they do their, with like beanbags and like an actual auditorium, like raised up, like a sort of theatre-y type thing.
Yeah.
And they've got beanbags everywhere and cushions. That's where they do their company meetings. They've got a room full of table tennis tables. They've got PlayStations everywhere. They've got loads of different breakout areas and stuff. And sometimes when you walk into these places, you think, God, guys, really? But I don't know, there's something about it when you're in there. It all comes across as quite sincere. You see people using it. You see people having meetings in these areas and stuff like that. And like a lot of the conversation we went on to have while I was there, I interviewed their CTO, Lee James, and he was sort of talking about sort of the importance of creating a culture where people within a company, where people feel comfortable, because he said that's like the most important part of a digital transformation. People get so caught up in like, what technologies are we going to use? What are our processes and policies and procedures? He said, but then if you haven't got people bought into it, or you know, people don't feel comfortable, they kind of feel, oh, this is just work. You know, they're not engaged in what they're doing, you might not get the right results. So that kind of set the scene for, have a tour of our office and this is what we're doing. But they have this initiative and branding at Rackspace. It's all over the walls saying it's okay to be me. It's kind of to show people, you know, just bring your whole self to work. When you come here, don't think, okay, I'm in work now, I will set aside the fact that I'm a fan of this football team or that I like to do this in my spare time. That's you know, this is work, that's my out of work time. So as you walk around there, they've got they're really kind of big on people expressing their individualism. So if you're from a different country, some people who work there, they've got their flags above their desks to show sort of where they're from in the world and stuff like that. And all the teams are kind of allowed, I think probably within certain limits, to sort of dictate how the areas should be decorated, where they work. So you kind of see this kind of coming together of people's interests and stuff like that. So it's
maybe we should do that at Computer Weekly.
It's something I'm going to be writing up the interview with him. But yeah, it was just a really, really interesting conversation. And he's like a really, I'd say, interesting guy. Lots of philosophies and stuff. He talked a lot about Fortnite, the game.
Oh, the game, yeah.
Yeah, and just how sort of aspects of that could inform how maybe digital transformation should happen in companies and stuff like that. So there's like this mode in Fortnite where you go off on missions together as a squad, and he's like, you know, you have to all work together to achieve this goal, but if one of you decides to go rogue, like, you know what, you got to go over there and like go do a battle, I'm just going to
stand here and
so you may as well just switch the game off. Don't use the game. But so he's got some analogies around that which I'll go into in the article. But yeah, it's a really interesting chat, and they're interesting company. Like I say, he said this kind of attitude, though, that, you know, it's okay to be me, this kind of thing about bringing yourself to work. It's not just a UK thing. It's, you know, it's a big part of the company ethos across the world as well.
Authentic selves.
Yes, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And like I said, they have gone through a lot of changes, Rackspace. They went, they went private a couple of years ago. Uh-huh. So they're a publicly listed company. They started off as like the one to beat in public cloud, and then obviously that lead got eroded by AWS rising to prominence and stuff like that. So they've had to kind of rejig their business model a bit now. So they've moved from being a competitor to kind of a collaborator with AWS. So they don't sort of directly compete so much with them anymore, because they sell managed services around sort of AWS to help enterprises use AWS technology with greater ease. And they do the same with Google and Microsoft now, and their business on that front is really, really growing. So you kind of think, well, you're doing all this in the background around kind of, you know, with your teams, is that feeding into that? Is that why that is proving successful as well? So
ideas, different approaches. If you're like, this wasn't working, so what can we do? And if people feel like they can share, you're more likely to solve a problem.
Yeah, rather than just like, no, you know, carry on with public cloud, we'll carry on. Yeah. So, like I say, they had to go private, so I don't think their shareholders would have let them carry on like that. But, it's just, like I say, if that's kind of the secret of their success, or like that's how they say they operate, I think it's an interesting sort of another, I guess, an insight into how they're transforming their business as well, with cool. staff at the centre of it.
Yeah.
And then you took your authentic self.
Very authentic. There's a lot of very inauthentic people there, I saw. Like, lots of plastic surgery going on. But, yeah, that's by the by. But, yes, so, yeah, I went to, yeah, Data Cloud Europe Congress, which is a huge data centre show that happens every year. Basically, everyone from the whole data centre industry in the UK, Europe, convenes in Monaco for this every year.
God, that's messy.
It is. It really is. It's interesting because it's all about the co-location side of the data centre industry, and they are benefiting massively at the moment from AWS, Google and people like that not being able to build data centres fast enough to sort of meet user needs. So it's a real growth industry. So there's, you know, that portion of things is covered off quite extensively at the show, but it's also really about like the nuts and bolts of the data centre industry as well. Mm-hmm. So it's for like the sort of the mechanics side of things. So depending on how interesting you find it, I find it very, very interesting.
Like, I'm finding it very, very complicated sounding.
You know, lots of talk about kind of cooling systems and how different tech trends are maybe going to inform the design of data centres in the years to come. Because we have there's like this, the data centre industry has this reputation for never wanting to change.
Well, because it's not going to work.
Yeah. Because it's kind of, well, you know, they're mission critical facilities. So there is always this attitude of like, things will always work this way, let's not rock the boat, let's just keep things as they are.
I don't want to
like,
muck
it.
About it here.
So there is this kind of, okay, let's just keep doing things the way we always have. But then there's new technology trends emerging that mean like end user expectations around sort of online services are changing. You know, people expect things, you know, this is not a phrase anyone uses, it's mine, I'm trademarking it. You know, people get aggy if Netflix gets laggy. So
I love it.
So, you know, that means that maybe it doesn't work just having like these huge centralised data centres sort of delivering services to people from other sides of the globe and stuff like that. So there's this push towards edge data centres, which is like a big discussion point in the show, having like smaller data centres sort of on peripheries to sort of deliver services closer to users and stuff like that. There's a lot of hype and confusion about what that actually looks like at the minute. But
well, I mean, it makes sense, and there are other parts of technology that work in the same way. Mm-hmm. Even if you think of downloading sites where you have, if you have more seeds in more locations, you get your download quicker.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
Because kind of
they do have things like they're called like content delivery networks that do some of this at the moment. But with, like, say there is like the end user side of things, but then there's also like things like IoT, autonomous cars, more things coming on to, that need network support.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, well, we need to maybe change our model a bit, and that means changing maybe the way data centres are designed. So, like I say, different ways of cooling. You know, if there's smaller data centres in remote locations, can we really justify having a person there? Do we need a person there? Can we run it all through software and things like that? So there's all these kind of ideas. You know, the industry needs to change, it needs to kind of find new ways of doing things, and they are, you know, there's lots of examples at the show of things, how they're using machine learning and AI and stuff like this. Also, you know, like I say, new ways of keeping facilities cool, new use cases for data centres as well, which are kind of quite interesting. So there's all that, and then sort of the backbone of it all is like, yes, the data centre needs to change, but we can't hire it, right? We can't find enough staff to work in data centres to deliver all this change. So you think that is, you know, part of it as well, is that they need new ideas, but they can't find any fresh blood to bring into the industry.
And the ones who are in the industry are in Monaco.
They're like, don't even think about asking them to do anything.
Is this because the received images, who's that character in Silicon Valley?
The guy
with the ponytail who looks after the machines.
Yes.
In the basement somewhere.
And he just looks a bit spaced out, and like whenever he sees another person, he's a bit like, So like he hasn't seen sunlight for a long time. There's lots of different reasons for it. Like it's it's talked about all the time at a lot of data center conferences, like why can't we get people into this industry? And there's a lot, like there's things like as basic as it's an industry that relies on secrecy. Like people don't want to know, don't want to tell people where their data centers are. They'd rather they didn't know how they worked, because
it
matters of national
point.
Exactly.
National security.
So there's like that side of things, and then there was a skills panel at the show which was quite interesting. They're saying that they want new people, they want younger people to start working in data centres.
Yeah.
And but then when say, data center operators get in contact with recruiters about this kind of stuff. They're like, yeah, we want someone who's new, we want new ideas, but they've got to have at least 5 years experience of working in data centers.
Where are those magical people? They're like unicorns.
Exactly. So it's like, well, that's not going to happen. So there was a guy that I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he's from an organization in the US called Salute, who they basically bring ex US veterans through like a retraining program.
Oh, okay.
And bring them into sort of data center careers.
Oh, nice. Yeah,
because they're saying they get like the, yeah, this
security
is mission
aspect.
Yeah, they totally get what mission critical means. They're very good at following orders, and yeah, they've had a lot of success there bringing people in that way.
Cool.
And there's lots.
So we need a bigger army then.
Yeah. I can't remember what the stats were. It was kind of amazing. I think like he said, like thousands of people who exit the military in the US every year. And it's like, well, what do you do with them?
So it's kind of like the US Armed Forces must just be incredibly big.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's you kind of have a time. There's a time limit. You have to be fit. You know, you have to be of a certain age and a certain capability to do particular jobs in the military. And if you don't end up getting to the top ranks where you're calling the shots, then you're well, calling the shots. That's a bad phrase to use, isn't it?
I don't know.
Probably the perfect phrase.
Literally calling the shots.
What are you going to do? You have a certain skill set. You have a certain set of skills.
Yeah, but they said also army spouses as well. They kind of bring in through that way as well, because you've moved around a lot. You kind of, well, you'll need a career as well.
Yeah, true.
So there was that side of it. There's another company there called Future Tech, who are like a UK
based. I've heard of them. Yeah,
yeah, they're a UK based design data center design company based in Reading. And the guy there said, "Oh, we have the problem that a lot of people don't want to come and work in Reading." So, but they've started sort of broadening how they approach recruitment now. So they don't do the five, oh, we need 5 years experience. They're not so bothered about, yeah, well, I'll say they're not so bothered, but, you know, degrees aren't the be all and end all. They are happy to sort of bring on sort of junior engineers and stuff like that, with the idea that you can teach them on the job.
Yeah.
So what they do is they do aptitude training and personality profiling to get their new recruits.
Yeah.
And they partner up with a sort of more senior engineer. And they said as long as they've got like they've got the right attitude, they can learn, they've got like a degree of intelligence, meaning they can learn.
Yeah.
You partner them up with someone like that and they come on so much quicker than trying to go through kind of, let's bring in an engineer who's probably, you know, learned about engineering in a more general sense. Now let's make them, you know, hone their skills particularly for data centres. You know, that's a huge learning curve.
It's a jump, isn't it?
Yeah, and it takes a long time to onboard them. So it's hearing those kind of approaches which I think they need. It
makes so much more sense.
So that was, I'd say the industry needs change, they need people to deliver the change, so
there we go.
That was the thing.
Well, I'm not sure I'd recommend these ex-service personnel going to shipping, because we've just published what I think is a really brilliant feature on autonomous ships.
Oh, really?
Yes, ships that will require no mariners on board.
Well, when you said we would be talking about autonomous boats, what I was thinking was a party boat where you go to drink champagne and sit in the middle of a lagoon. I'm guessing that that's not quite the aim here.
No, it's just like you have self-driving cars or self-driving boats. And there's a feature by Stephen Matheson. I won't say too much about it. It's probably just better if people go read it. Norway's autonomous ships point to new horizons. It's actually my headline. That was my contribution to this.
I don't want to use up the word count on my headline.
And it's about autonomous ships being used in Norway. There's a few very interesting projects. Also, it has this kind of wiggly coastline.
Yeah.
It has a lot of need for ferries, you know, between the mainland and the islands and things like that. So there's three things that Stephen talks about already being deployed, and there's some nice pictures of these self-driving ships as well. And one interesting thing about all the three projects that Stephen talks about in Norway is that environmental efficiency is the real big benefit, because of obviously they're powered by electricity and not by fossil fuels, And reducing the need for road transport with the freight boats that he writes about. So that's quite interesting. And also in general, Norway is much further ahead of the UK in terms of decarbonising its transport. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So electric cars and hybrid cars make up to about 40% of recent sales. Which is pretty interesting. Scandinavia is very often in advance of us in all sorts of ways.
Yeah.
But I suppose the big question is, maybe all very well having these little self-driving boats in and around the Norwegian coast or the UK coast. but what about like long haul freight?
Yeah.
But there, the thing that seems to be maybe retarding that is that, sadly, mariners at sea, the guys on these massive ships, and there'll just be a handful of them on a massive ship, and these ships do have quite a lot of, they're very efficient already, these big freight ships. But the guys on board are paid very little anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's not a huge opportunity for saving money there. But it could be done, that sort of thing, you know, to have. And certainly adding more and more autonomy to shipping is the way to go. And it's very much in line with that industry.
Mm.
Globalisation, we often talk about that glibly, but shipping is absolutely key to moving this stuff around the world.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting industry it's a super feature.
So is it just like defined routes? Like just, is that what they're using it for at the minute? Like Okay. You can see certain like ferry rides, just if you think about like the ones that just do that, like the ones on the Thames that take you from here to there. You can see
like Portsmouth to Isle of Wight or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah. Which is on, I think, a cable anyway. So it's like, captain, yeah.
I didn't know that.
There is an Isle of Wight ferry on cable, yeah.
And I did promise you my, what I believe to be a very cool idea for a children's book.
Have you trademarked it before you say too much?
Trademark? No, I haven't trademarked it. I haven't copyright protected it.
Keep talking. I'm taking
I'm almost certainly never get around to doing it. But it would be a kid's book about the boats of the Venetian Lagoon. So the Vaporetti, the gondolas, the big cruise ships. Because a lot of different types of water transport in Venice. And obviously they would talk.
Thomas the Tank Engine on water.
Yeah.
Or like cars.
Yeah.
Boats.
But if you were to introduce an autonomous boat, that'd be another level of. Because they're talking already, aren't they?
Yeah.
And I thought, the cruise ships, because they're really unpopular, right?
Venice,
to have those big, bulky. So you could have, the cruise ship. He would know that he's not really welcome. And he's, kind of self-effacing about it and trying to make himself small and things like that. I think it's like a super idea.
Yeah, you have the autonomous ones because they're just such sticklers for following rules and being told what to do. They could, that's like another character.
Yeah.
They'd be like, not much fun.
I just need someone to draw the pictures.
That's everybody's problem.
Next week,
we've got
London Tech Week, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, lots of events and launches probably next week to coincide with that, which will be keeping us all very busy, I'm sure.
Yes, indeed.
And there's lots of executives knocking around because I've got numerous lunches and things. Do you want to meet our CEO, etc.? So my diary is pretty packed out with those kind of things next week.
Yeah, same.
Well, there we go.
So all we've got time for this week, it just remains for me to say thank you very much indeed to Caroline on her birthday.
You're welcome.
Happy birthday.
Happy to have graced you with my presence.
And thanks to Claire.
Thanks.
And thanks to you guys for listening. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.